Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello, good morning, and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I think everyone has an image of someone who suffers from an eating disorder in their mind. Much of this is based off of TV or movie portrayals, maybe someone who is severely underweight or sneaking off to throw up after every meal. However, the reality of eating disorders is far more complex and much more common than I even realized. 9% of the U.S. population will have an eating disorder in their lifetime. But even more surprising to me is that less than 6% of people with eating disorders are diagnosed as underweight. Today, on Line One, I am happy to welcome Dr. Christine Peet, who is the director of the National Center of Excellence on Eating Disorders, and Jenny Loudon, who is co-founder of the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance. Our goal is to discuss the main types of eating disorders, including those in higher weight bodies, and learn about the treatment and resources available in Alaska. The main types are anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, OSFED, which stands for Other Specified Feeding or Eating Disorders, and ARFID, which stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. If you have a question, we welcome them. Please call us toll-free, statewide. The number is 1-888-353-5752. 888-353-5752. If you're in the Anchorage area, you can call us at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. You can also email me at line1, that's spelled out L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Well, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Peet on the show today. Dr. Peet, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I want to give you an opportunity here to introduce yourself to the listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself, where you are, and what you do.
Yeah, happy to. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and I've really focused on eating disorders for the entirety of my career. I'm currently an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And as you mentioned, I'm the director of the National Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders.
Great. How'd you get interested in this subject? Like, what was it about eating disorders that made you want to go into further training on it?
Sure. Well, I am the daughter of a physician and someone who kind of grew up in a medical family, but was always really interested in behavior. And I think that intersection of medical morbidity in addition to behavior is that sort of sweet spot of where eating disorders land. So really from a very early age was interested in eating disorders and decided to pursue that throughout my undergraduate training and then on my way to get my doctorate as well.
Good. And tell me and our listeners a little bit about the National Center of Excellence on Eating Disorders. What is this organization? What's the goals, purpose of it?
The National Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders, or what we refer to as NCED, is actually the nation's first and only federally funded center that's dedicated to eating disorders. And our entire mission is really devoted to providing education and training to healthcare providers and also some to the general public on how you detect and manage eating disorders in clinical practice.
Very, very interesting. And I also want to welcome Jenny Loudon. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Okay. Loudon now. And Jenny here has done a lot of work in Alaska as the co-founder of the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance. So thank you for, I should say, welcome back to Line One. You've been on before. But if you wouldn't mind telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, about your institution, and you know, how that came to be.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I am Jenny Loudon, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance, along with my other co-founder, Beth Rose. And Beth and I both actually have known each other for several decades. We were part of a book club together, of all things. What we didn't know, we would go about our book club and have these conversations, but we didn't know that we were both suffering, really, from having loved ones with eating disorders. And so we were going about trying to find appropriate resources, appropriate supports, appropriate treatments, but we weren't talking about it because this is something that you don't go about your daily life normally talking about. And so when we realized that we were both along these paths, but going on a parallel path rather than being able to help each other, we really came together with the idea that we wanted to start an organization so that other Alaskans would not be having to walk this path alone, but that there could be supports, resources, we could do something to really improve the life of Alaskans who are impacted by eating disorders.
Yeah, no, that's a great story. How long have you guys been doing this?
Yeah, we incorporated in September of 2019. So you can imagine that's not very many months before March of 2020. So we knew that there were needs and there were gaps in care before the pandemic. But very shortly after we started, the pandemic did happen. And we know that the rates of eating disorders really skyrocketed during that time. And the latest research shows that they have not yet come back to pre-pandemic numbers. And so it still continues to be an ongoing problem of just rising rates of eating disorders, of people showing up, wanting help, and usually at much higher acuity levels than before the pandemic. So there's really been great needs from the beginning of the start of our organization.
Yeah, no, that's we've dealt with that a lot through with bariatric surgery as well, through the just the difficulties of the pandemic that we saw with our patient population. So, well, let's get into the eating disorders a little bit. I want to start more general, and I'll start with you, Dr. Pete. Can you give our listeners the most basic sort of what is an eating disorder, you know, in general?
Sure. So, you know, obviously, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, eating disorders encompass a number of different diagnoses. But in general, what they all have in common is that someone is in some way struggling with their relationship with food, struggling with their relationship with their body, sometimes both. And this is something that tends to be really pervasive across somebody's life. So this isn't something that is just sort of disliking a certain type of food, for example, or, you know, maybe having some degree of unhappiness with a certain part of your body. It's something that really kind of can take over your entire life and be something that is all consuming, both for the person that's struggling with an eating disorder, and as Jenny mentioned, also for the people that love them.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's really where the relationship with food is unhealthy, per se. Jenny, do you have any addition to sort of the layperson's idea of what an eating disorder is?
Absolutely. We always like to remind people that this is not just a fad or not just a lifestyle. It is really something that's very serious. It's complex. It's potentially life-threatening. And in addition to those persistent disturbances in eating behaviors, what we really see is that there's really distressing emotions and distressing thoughts about food and eating that come along with it. So it really does encompass not just the behaviors, but the emotional life that someone is experiencing when they have that eating disorder.
Okay. So interesting question here. And I think this is a complex to think about, but maybe simple to answer. I don't know. And I'll pose it to both of you guys. Is an eating disorder, is this relationship with food or emotions, is this a choice or is it an illness? I know it seems like a simple or maybe a dumb question on the surface, but it goes quite deep to the root of the issue, mm-hmm. I think. Dr. Pete, I'll start with you.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's a dumb question. And I'm really glad we're having the opportunity to talk about it. We really do think about eating disorders as illnesses. Yes, there are behavioral components. Yes, there are emotions and thoughts that are involved. But people do not choose an eating disorder, given especially what Jenny said about how life-threatening these conditions can be. We think about these as illnesses, particularly because they can start really with sort of this insidious onset and get worse in a relatively short amount of time. But there's also been a number of research studies done over the last several decades looking at the natural course and progression of these kinds of conditions. And we really do understand them as mental illnesses in the same way that we do depression and anxiety.
Excellent. And Jenny, I'll offer you the same question.
Yeah, thank you. I really think of eating disorders as being a perfect storm. It's not a choice. It's an illness. It's a perfect storm where all kinds of things come together to create the circumstances that can allow an eating disorder to really flourish. And those can include things like the genetics of a person. It can include their brain chemistry. It can include their environment that they've grown up in, the social and cultural influences. There's all of these things that are out there that come together and they create this perfect storm, but it is definitely not a choice. And this gets into the issues of like really what causes eating disorders. And I want to just add that one of the things that you did not hear me say in those causes was parents. And I have to bring this up all the time because there was a period of time 40, 50 years ago where people did think that parents were somehow at the cause of an eating disorder in their child. And what we now know based on a lot of decades of research is that that is absolutely not true. So we like to debunk that old thought and also help empower parents to know that they can actually be their child's greatest advocate, their greatest support, and can make a really big difference in helping their child to recover. So we'd like to make sure that parents know that they are not the cause of the illness.
Absolutely. So with that, I'll piggyback a little bit. I want to remind our listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Pete or Jenny today, in Anchorage, it's 907-550-8433. Statewide, 888-353-5752, or email me, line1@alaskapublic.org. I have an email here from Anonymous. And she's concerned that she wants to know if she should be concerned about some eating habits with her teenage daughter. So I'll read you guys here a little bit of it. But it's basically that the daughter deals with anxiety and depression, a few other issues, including mild OCD. And when she's struggling or in a position of social anxiety, she will tend to eat very, very little. This could continue for several days. And then there's several weeks or months in between these short episodes. And so this mother is concerned that this might be some kind of eating disorder. Although she seems healthy, she sees a therapist, and doesn't have any serious physical issues. So should she be concerned about this? Jenny, I'll start with you this time.
Sure. And, you know, obviously, I'm not a therapist and I'm not a doctor, so I wouldn't be able to diagnose even if I had this patient in front of me. But I will say one of the things that has really stuck with me that was stated by a physician from Children's Hospital in Seattle. And she said, you know, there are often many things that come into a physician's office where they take a wait and see attitude. It's like, well, let's wait. Let's look and see how are things happening. Come back in a week. Come back in a month. She said any concerns about eating disorders do not fall in that category. She said anytime we have anything where we suspect that something might be happening, the best course of action is to really take it very seriously, to do further investigation, because we know that the best course of treatment and the best likelihood of recovery happens when there's immediate, quick, and very intensive treatment early on. So I think if this mother has any concerns at all, it's very reasonable to follow up, to check with the child's therapist. Oftentimes people feel very they feel very shameful about eating disorders. And so what we hear from therapists all the time is that they might be seeing a patient for even a decade, and the patient might share their deepest, darkest secrets, their traumas of their past, all sorts of things without actually coming into the room and saying, you know, I'm struggling with this eating behavior. So oftentimes it's not something that just shows up. They need help. They need curiosity. And so any support we can provide to help patients to share what they're really experiencing with food can really be life-saving.
Absolutely. So Dr. Pete, same question. Is this concerning? Are you concerned? Or if you are, like, where does someone start with getting, getting the screening tools available? I know you guys have links and resources on your websites, but if you could explain that.
Sure. You know, I think I'll start just by echoing some of what Jenny said about the need to act quickly if there are any concerns. I couldn't agree more about the idea that waiting and seeing can be really challenging, especially when it comes to eating disorders. I think it's also important to keep in mind that anxiety disorders often go hand in hand with an eating disorder. So we may not necessarily be talking about one or the other. It may be a both situation. And above and beyond that, many people with eating disorders, especially young people, may appear perfectly healthy. Most individuals with eating disorders are not going to have really obvious or frank signs or symptoms. Many people may be struggling in secret, and these things may not even necessarily show up on physical exams in a doctor's office or on lab values, which is part of why they're so tricky to kind of detect and manage in that respect. As you mentioned, here at NSEED, we do have a number of different tools that are available. They're primarily for physicians and for other medical providers in terms of that screening component, but I'll point to a couple of things. There are a couple of products that we have developed that are specifically for parents and caregivers. So if, for example, you suspect that your child has an eating disorder, how might you approach that at your next pediatrician visit? And that's easily found on our website. In addition to that, one of the other things that might be useful to think about are some of the free national resources that are available. So, the National Eating Disorders Association has sort of like a patient-facing screener. It's a self-report measure that someone could actually just respond to these questions, and it would let you know whether or not the symptoms are concerning for an eating disorder. That's the National Eating Disorders Association. And there's actually an organization called Project HEAL that offers free assessments for anyone that might be concerned that they have an eating disorder. That's Project HEAL, HEAL. So both of those are more individual and family facing and would be a great place to start.
Great, great. I hope that answers your question there to the anonymous email. So we have, me see where the best place to go here is. I do have a caller, and I'm going to take that call in a moment. What is, so I guess one of the things you said is can you tell if somebody has an eating disorder by looking at them? Dr. Pete.
I think it's one of the biggest stereotypes that we have, actually, that there's a particular look for eating disorders, but it's absolutely untrue. The data have shown this over and over again. You cannot tell if someone has an eating disorder simply by looking at them. As I mentioned before, most people with eating disorders are going to appear healthy. They're going to appear fairly asymptomatic. These are conditions that we know thrive in secrecy. So there are many ways in which individuals are trying to hide or conceal their symptoms. Again, not everybody has really significant weight loss. Most people are not going to be underweight if they have an eating disorder. So if that's sort of the mental image that we have, we're going to end up missing the vast majority of folks who are struggling with these conditions. So I think it's really important that we're cluing into other things, some of which we've already talked about and Jenny pointed out. So for example, any of those changes that you might see in someone's behavior around food, if you're noticing changes in mood or anxiety symptoms, oftentimes those can be early warning signs of an eating disorder. But we know certainly that eating disorders don't have a particular look.
Thank you. Thank you for answering that question. I'd like to take our first caller from Anchor Point. Kristen, welcome to line one.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I'm wondering because I hear about these food, the bulimia and anorexia, and actually had a friend one time who suffered from bulimia. But I'm kind of wondering because you hear it about here in the United States and over in Europe, but you don't hear much about eating disorders in third world countries in the global South, where food insecurity is runs much higher than it does here in the Western areas. So how much of eating disorders is just based on societal pressures and the availability of food?
All right, Kristen, welcome. That's a great question. Wow, getting high level there. I like it. I'm gonna pose this to our guests here. I'll have you take the answer off air, but I guess Jenny, do you want to start with this one? You're here. I guess what is the societal relationship and cultural relationship with eating disorders?
Absolutely. The societal, I talked earlier about how there's this perfect storm of things that can come together, and certainly the societal expectations about what an appearance, an ideal appearance might look like is definitely one of those things that can really impact eating disorders. I would say that a lot of the how we hear about eating disorders in America or Europe or other not necessarily in third world countries, my guess is a lot of that actually has to do with the fact of where we do our research. I don't know if we really know too much about the actual prevalence rates. What we do know, there is some actually very interesting research that's been done recently about the impact of food insecurity on eating disorders. And what we have found actually is that food insecurity can also be a predictor for eating disorders. You can imagine that potentially if you are getting food stamps, you might have lots of food available early in the month, so you might binge more and eat more foods. And then as you have lesser access to foods as it goes along in the month, that you get more into a restrictive. And so this can kind of create these binge and restrict cycles that are kind of an underlying factor within a lot of eating disorders. So actually, food insecurity can be a big risk factor for eating disorders to be developed.
Very interesting. Dr. Pete, I'm going to let you answer the same question, but first I need to take a quick break. And I just want to remind the listeners that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guests today, call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752, 888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on eating disorders with Dr. Christine Pete and Jenny Loudon.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bristol Bay Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will develop proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting March 8th and 9th in Naknek. More information at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined by Dr. Christine Pete and Jenny Loudon from the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance. Call us toll-free statewide, 888-353-5752. 888-353-5752 or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433, or email me, line1@alaskapublic.org. So Dr. Pete, we're responding to Kristen's call about kind of the cultural differences in eating disorders. So I want you to answer that, but also piggyback a little bit on, you know, the stereotypical eating disorder that we see on TV and Lifetime programs is the white woman or the teenager. Who gets eating disorders? Women, men, is it more common in certain races? Maybe you can expound upon that a little bit more.
Sure, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that stereotype about who is affected by eating disorders is really pervasive. It's something that is seen throughout pop culture, but frankly also in healthcare and in sort of training settings as well. The reality is that eating disorders don't discriminate. As we've said before during this program, eating disorders don't have a particular look. But that also means that eating disorders don't affect a particular age, a particular body type, a particular race or ethnicity, or socioeconomic status. And in fact, one of the challenges is that if you don't fit that particular stereotype of who usually struggles with an eating disorder, you're actually less likely to be detected. And if you aren't detected with an eating disorder, you're then less likely to receive care. It's then possible that you end up struggling with this condition for a longer period of time. So, you know, as the science progresses and as we start to do more data collection on some of these populations that haven't always been included before, I think we're starting to develop a much more robust understanding of who might struggle and how. One of the really important underpinnings that has come out here in recent years is actually some of the genetic understanding of eating disorders. First and foremost, we know that these are biologically based illnesses. And so even though all of us are exposed to this kind of toxic culture when it comes to beauty standards and expectations around food and eating and health, not everyone will have an eating disorder. So that being said, we understand that these are individuals who are genetically predisposed to experience these conditions that then also are exposed to the same kind of toxic culture.
Yeah, so it could be a combination of factors. You may have someone who, through genetics, is predisposed to get an eating disorder, and then they may never actually get it. This is similar to, you know, I would say we did a show on alcoholism, as someone may be predisposed to addiction and alcoholism but never get it. But if you get involved in stressful situations or lifestyle things or things that can trigger that sort of thing, is that what you're getting at?
That's exactly right. There's a possibility that for some people who have a genetic loading for these kinds of conditions, it may never end up getting expressed. But if you are genetically primed for this kind of condition, and then you add in some of the environmental triggers, maybe it's family triggers, maybe it's personal sort of psychology in your makeup. And as Jenny said before, it's kind of this perfect storm that can end up expressing itself.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So let's, I do want to get to defining some of the different types of eating disorders for our listeners. I guess just before we do that, Dr. Pete, if you could give our listeners an idea of the general principles of care, what we're looking to do with these diagnoses. It's very multi-specialty, right? This isn't just one-on-one with a single provider. Like, what is the general principles of multi-specialty care?
The general principles when we're thinking about treating eating disorders is that it really does have to be a multidisciplinary approach. As we've been talking about throughout this program, eating disorders, you know, sort of deal with not only certain behaviors, but also moods and thoughts. And in addition to that, there can be some very significant medical morbidity that goes along with these conditions. So in recognition of all of those different facets of an eating disorder, it's important that we have specialists who are treating each of those specific areas. So the treatment is often driven by a psychologist or by some sort of mental health care provider who is doing evidence-based care for an eating disorder. So that might be a certain type of psychotherapy. It may be group-based. It may be individual. But there's always kind of this psychological component. In addition to that, there are dietitians who deliver what we call medical nutrition therapy, which is a specific type of intervention that specialty dietitians implement with folks that are struggling with these conditions. And it really helps them to help normalize their pattern of eating, making sure that they're adequately nourished to do some of the really sort of heavy lifting when it comes to the mental health components. Above and beyond that, we also have a number of different medical providers who might be involved. So that might include a physician or another type of medical provider to be monitoring the physical health of a person with an eating disorder to make sure that there aren't any really negative effects of things like malnourishment or significant amounts of weight loss, for example. And it's really this kind of team-based approach where all of these different types of professionals are working together to make sure that the treatment plan is implemented in a way that's consistent and helps get a person towards recovery.
No, excellent. So multidisciplinary team involved. And Jenny, why don't you chime in on, okay, so we talked a lot of, that's all the medical aspects, but there's a heck of a lot of non-medical support resources that are required too. What does that component of the care entail?
Sure. In addition, I want to just piggyback on what Christine said, because that is the gold standard, is to have this multidisciplinary team and have this team that's working together collaboratively. So it's not even just individual providers doing their work, but they're talking to each other. They're sharing information. They're working together for the betterment of this individual. We know that's not a very easy thing to come by anywhere. It's particularly difficult in Alaska. I do want to just remind listeners that we do have a listing on the Akita website of some of the local providers here in Alaska who are doing this kind of work. It can be hard to put together a team, but we encourage people to reach out and to seek those providers that are on the list. If listeners are providers and want to be on that list, we're always trying to add people so that people who are struggling know who to reach out to. But I will just say that in addition to that team, we always include family members as part of that support system. If you have an adolescent or a young adult who's living in your house, you can see how that would be a very important person. But even if you're not an adolescent, we just know that having support is really helpful. Changing these behaviors is very difficult. It might sound not like a difficult thing to have a meal plan where you need to eat 3 meals a day, maybe 3 snacks a day on a consistent basis. If you don't have an eating disorder, that sounds like not a very difficult prescription. But if you do have an eating disorder, that's asking you to do something very, very anxiety producing every single day. And so having support from family members who have the specialty support, skills, knowledge to know how to best support their loved one can make all the difference in the world.
Excellent. Yeah. So let's go through a couple of the types of eating disorders. And I don't want to spend a huge amount of time because I really do want to focus on the resources available. But I think it's important to define some of these illnesses. And so we'll kind of run through a few of them. But so, Dr. Pete, anorexia nervosa, probably one of the more common ones that people think about. What is it? What are the symptoms? Kind of give us a rundown in as short a time as possible, I guess. I'm sorry to do that to you, but of anorexia nervosa.
Happy to keep it succinct. When we think about the hallmark of anorexia nervosa, we're actually thinking about an individual that has an extreme fear of weight gain or an extreme fear of quote unquote becoming fat. And these individuals are ones that will then restrict their diet so that either they become underweight or they may lose really large amounts of weight. So I know that the stereotype is that folks with anorexia nervosa tend to be very thin or underweight, and these are individuals that don't eat anything at all. In reality, these are individuals that are eating. They're just eating very, very limited amounts or very limited variety. In addition to that, I think it's important to highlight something that is currently termed atypical anorexia nervosa, which is actually much more common than sort of that traditional definition of anorexia nervosa. Folks with atypical are oftentimes struggling with the exact same kinds of thought patterns, the exact same behaviors, the same sort of dietary restriction, but they may not be at a lower weight. These may be individuals that live in higher weight bodies, for example. And these individuals oftentimes go undetected because instead of having sort of warning signs go off about weight loss, these individuals can be congratulated many times for their weight loss. So they can really fly under the radar in that regard.
Interesting. Okay, so that's anorexia, atypical anorexia. We'll stay with you, Dr. Pete, but let's go on to bulimia.
Bulimia nervosa is a diagnosis that's characterized by recurrent binge eating episodes followed by these behaviors that are geared towards sort of making up for that binge eating episode. I just want to unpack both of those kind of briefly. When we think about binge eating episodes, we're really not necessarily thinking about a huge volume of food. That might be true for some individuals, but the hallmark characteristic of a binge eating episode is a sense of feeling out of control. I cannot stop eating once I've started, even if I wanted to stop. It's that sense of being out of control that really defines a binge eating episode, not so much the amount of food. So when individuals experience those types of binge eating episodes, they might then try to compensate or make up for that type of binge by doing things like engaging in self-induced vomiting, maybe using certain medications to try and get rid of that food or that weight. Sometimes it's exercise, but it's really the pairing of that binge eating in addition to one of those behaviors that classifies or describes bulimia nervosa.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I mean, we're not talking about, you know, I'll eat a huge meal on Thanksgiving and then I'll be like, man, I got to work this off, you know, the next week, or I might step up my exercise routine. That's a little different, right? We're talking about something that's more compulsive. Is that right?
You know, it's an interesting question. It sort of depends on the person, right? Because for many people, it may start as insidiously as that. It may start as, gosh, I ate a lot on Thanksgiving or some of the other winter holidays, and now I'm just going to make sure that I exercise a little bit more. Maybe I eat a little bit less the next day. And for some folks, that may be where it ends. It may never progress any further. But again, for some of those folks that are genetically predisposed to eating disorders, it can be as simple as that for them to kind of get into this cascade of a full threshold eating disorder.
Interesting. Okay. And I want to remind our listeners, if you have questions about eating disorders, please give us a call, 888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Let's go on. And so, Jenny, let me ask you if you have anything to contribute to the anorexia, atypical anorexia, or bulimia before we move on to some of the others.
Yeah, I think Dr. Pete did a great job of explaining what those are. I do just want to highlight to atypical anorexia, because so many people do not know about this, and it's really a growing number of people who are seeking assistance and seeking support. And I think that sometimes people with atypical anorexia might think like, oh, but I'm not sick enough yet. I'm not thin enough. I haven't reached that emaciated look that people associate with anorexia. And so I don't deserve treatment. I'm not sick enough yet. And what we know is that atypical anorexia is very, very life-threatening. They have a double death rate compared to age-matched peers. You can imagine when you just lose a lot of weight very quickly, it puts a lot of stress on your body. And so that weight suppression alone causes a lot of medical complications. And so we just really like to remind people that that atypical anorexia really is just as worthy of treatment and just as life-threatening as the other eating disorders.
Thank you for that. Dr. Pete, let's go on to binge eating, and this is definitely a different sort of illness. Can you explain what I know you did a little bit about what binging is, but let's go into the actual binge eating disorder.
Right. So binge eating disorder is a diagnosis that's characterized by those same sorts of binge eating episodes that we described in bulimia nervosa. But there isn't this kind of more regular pairing of a binge eating episode with one of those behaviors to try and make up for it. So really, these are individuals that are experiencing this loss of control over their eating. They may at times be eating large volumes of food. During a binge, many people will talk about eating faster than they normally do, eating to the point where they become uncomfortably full. Maybe they're eating alone because they're ashamed of what or how much they're eating. But invariably, these individuals are carrying around a huge amount of guilt and shame associated with that particular binge eating episode. And you can imagine if this is something that is happening 3-4 times a week, the cumulative amount of that kind of guilt and shame is almost palpable. So although these individuals may not be ones that immediately come to mind when we think about eating disorder diagnoses, it is actually a more common diagnosis than anorexia nervosa, for example. An almost equal number of men and women will struggle with this particular condition. So I think it's really important that we're talking about this diagnosis and having sort of a greater awareness of it.
So, you know, and obviously, you know, I'm a bariatric surgeon, so we deal with overweight and obese patients on a regular basis. Are binge eating patients more likely to be higher weight individuals? Because of the way that the disorder works, or does that not necessarily correlate?
Yeah, so I don't know that the science has gone so far as to say that it's because of the way the illness itself works. There are several studies looking at binge eating disorder in individuals that live in higher weight bodies, and there does appear to be a greater risk for binge eating the higher the weight. I do want to be really cautious, though, and say that this is not a causal factor in terms of weight or eating disorder, frankly. It's just been a noted correlation and something that I think is really regularly seen also in clinical practice. That being said, again, kind of coming full circle to what we talked about at the top of the hour, eating disorders don't have a particular look. So there are many individuals that struggle with binge eating disorder that actually, don't fit that profile of sort of that stereotype of living in a larger body. In fact, there have been a number of elite athletes who have come out in recent years talking about their struggle specifically with binge eating. So I think it just goes to show that your weight doesn't dictate whether or not you have an eating disorder diagnosis, and certainly not which diagnosis.
Okay. Well, just I want to take a few more minutes just to define these last couple of types before we get more into the resources and more of the general questions here. A couple that I did not have on my radar as a provider was OSFED and RFID. And if you wouldn't mind, Dr. Pete, if you could define both of those and explain what they are.
Sure. I'll start with OSFED. We have termed that other specified feeding and eating disorder. And essentially, these are individuals who may be engaging in eating disorder behaviors that look very similar to, let's say, binge eating disorder, or they look very similar to bulimia nervosa, but they just don't quite meet a threshold definition. So maybe they're not engaging in the behavior regularly enough to meet a threshold diagnosis, or maybe they've only been struggling with this particular behavior or thought pattern for a couple of weeks, and the diagnosis technically requires 3 months. So it's a somewhat arbitrary line that's been drawn, because essentially we're talking about the exact same behaviors, the exact same thought patterns. But because so many people with eating disorders tend to dabble in a handful of symptoms here, a handful of symptoms there, OSFED is actually the most common eating disorder diagnosis. I think it just kind of goes to show that the measurement or classification schemes that we have don't always fit human beings nicely, given how much variability there can be. Sure. When it comes to the other diagnosis of ARFID, that stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. And this is a newer diagnosis in the more recent version of the classification scheme. And the hallmark here is individuals who are failing to meet the nutritional needs that are required for essentially their daily activities of living. So these might be folks who are relying entirely on supplemental nutrition. These might be folks that have very limited amounts or types of foods that they're able to eat. And you might be thinking that sounds an awful lot like anorexia nervosa, and you'd be right, in some ways it does. But again, the hallmark of anorexia nervosa is this fear of gaining weight, a fear of being at a weight that someone has deemed too high. That is not the case in ARFID. People with ARFID are not meeting their nutritional needs, oftentimes because they have real difficulties with the sensory characteristics associated with food. So that might be a particular texture, a color, a shape, a smell. Or individuals are failing to meet those needs because of aversive experiences that they've had while eating. So for example, if you've had a choking accident, or if maybe you've had a really bad bout of nausea or some sort of GI distress, you might have learned to associate that with eating. And so now you're failing to meet your daily nutritional needs. And that's really kind of what encompasses or differentiates ARFID from anorexia nervosa.
Okay, great. Thank you for that definition. We're going to take our second and last mid-break here. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on eating disorders with Dr. Christine Peet and Jenny Loudon.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined by Dr. Christine Peet and Jenny Loudon from the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance. Call us toll-free statewide 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So we had an interesting email here that I wanted to bring up and allow you guys both to comment on. And it's a longer email, but I'll summarize here. There's new guidelines that came out recently from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And this is guidance on childhood obesity, which, you know, I'm acutely aware obesity is an epidemic in our country, and it's starting to affect our children more and more. So the guidelines are very geared towards identifying and early treatment of obesity. And the question goes to, is there any downside of this sort of guidelines from a healthcare practice standpoint if we spend too much time identifying or trying to intervene on higher weight children? Could that potentially create an eating disorder? So I want to pose that question to our experts here. And Jenny, I'll give you a chance to speak because we had Dr. Christine do so much of that second segment. Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Well, I'll start answering. I think that it's an excellent question, and it's one that many people within the eating disorders fields are very, very concerned about in regards to these new guidelines that came out. Just as some background, in 2016, was the last time that the American Academy of Pediatrics had some guidelines in regards to the same issue. And the recommendations were completely opposite from what they are now stating. And so before, the recommendations were things like, yeah, we recognize that the more often that a provider really focuses solely on weight as the defining characteristic of whether you're healthy or not, or really putting this focus, that it does create stigma, it does create shame, and that it often has the opposite effect that the provider wants. The provider might be thinking like, oh, I'm just helping you to be healthier. I'm helping you to encourage you to exercise more. But the reality is that that defining experience can actually oftentimes lead people into behaviors that can be maladaptive. And so the previous guidelines really discouraged providers from focusing on weight as the sole issue, and instead encouraging like, okay, what are you eating? How are you feeling about that? Are you getting a lot of variety? What kind of movement do you enjoy doing? How are you doing that? So really focusing more on outcomes of those rather than the weight in and of itself. And so there's a lot of concern amongst people in the eating disorders field. Many people we hear from here in Alaska and elsewhere will say that it was a conversation with a medical provider who told them that they needed to lose weight. Was kind of the thing that in their mind, if they were genetically predisposed for an eating disorder and all of those other things that we talked about, that could be kind of a linchpin that did kind of move things into the direction of an eating disorder. So there's concerns for those in the eating disorders field.
No, it's very interesting. And I'll play devil's advocate here a little bit, you know, as I pose it to Dr. Pete is, you know, we also hear the same thing from our obese or overweight patients looking to have surgery, that sometimes it was their doctor mentioning this is a problem or there are potential solution options in order to spur them into action. So I feel for the healthcare providers here because it's a very fine line.
Absolutely.
Between, you know, what might send someone one way or the other. So Dr. Pete, any comments on that?
Yeah, you know, I think as Jenny mentioned, this is a really delicate issue in the eating disorders field, and one that has been fraught with a lot of different challenges, a lot of which you both have mentioned, and particularly for healthcare providers. I do think that with guidelines, some of the things that can be really difficult are that guidelines are meant to be fairly general in nature. They're never going to be specific patient focused. So some of that, I think, creates just some difficulty in terms of interpretation. I do also think, though, that one of the things that could really benefit everyone across different settings, whether you work with adults or children, is to really focus on behavior. So as a psychologist, I know I'm biased because that's sort of my bread and butter, right? But when we're thinking about things that could be health promoting, it tends to be behaviors that can make a real difference, right? So if we're thinking about, for example, wanting to get people to eat a greater variety of foods, it would be a focus on how do we implement that, right? So if you're currently only eating, sort of highly calorie dense, highly palatable foods, how do we help move you in a direction where you're getting a certain amount of variety? In the same way, when it comes to other parts of your health, if you are currently struggling with symptoms of depression, for example, oftentimes you will start with a behavioral approach of getting people to have a more set schedule, helping to address their sleep. And those are discrete, measurable outcomes that we can be looking at that are health promoting for everyone, whether you are someone who lives in a higher weight body or not. And so I think that if we are giving people tangible tools and tangible things to focus on, that's a much more concrete way forward than simply saying a number on a certain scale has to change. So again, as a psychologist and as somebody who's really thinking about whole person wellness, I think that focusing on health promoting behaviors can make a really big difference.
No, absolutely. And I, you know, we echo that a lot through our office too. A weight is, and I hate giving people weight goals, because it's so unproductive and many times unrealistic, it's a little bit different of a perspective from weight loss, but, you know, we're looking at improving behaviors, you know, quality of life, metabolic rates and issues, improvements in comorbidities. So I think a lot of the goals are the same. It's just, you're right, how it's framed to the patient can make a big difference in the perspective that they feel.
Absolutely. And that, I think sometimes when we focus solely on the weight, it can have the opposite effect that we want it to have. Then all of a sudden it is the weight and maladaptive ways of doing it, rather than, as Christine, Dr. Pete mentioned, is those ways that you can make changes behaviorally that make you feel better, that make you help you to lead the life that you want to lead.
Absolutely. So we have a few more minutes here. I want to really spend the last few minutes on resources available in Alaska, or if they're not specifically available in Alaska, what's the connection to getting out-of-state resources? So Jenny, you're an expert here, and Dr. Pete, you know, you're amazing with your connection through all the way from North Carolina. So Jenny, let's start with you. Like, what are you guys doing at Akita to help with the resources in Alaska? Like, where does someone start? Mm-hmm.
Sure. If somebody is concerned and wants to receive help, I would say the first thing that people can do is reach out on our website. So we do have on the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance website, it's akeatingdisordersalliance.org. There's a listing there of Alaska providers, and it's listed by medical providers, the clinicians who are providing that psychological support, some folks who are doing some of the medication management, as well as dietitians. So people can go to that list and start seeing who are some of the people that are doing this work, who might I reach out to in order to try to get some support. I will note those are all outpatient providers. There's five different levels of care within the eating disorders framework of how to treat patients. It can start at the inpatient level, where all you are doing is trying to reach physical medical stability of somebody, and then going down into all of the different levels to outpatient. And if you are wanting to get help in Alaska, outpatient care is really what it's at. We have a little bit of some of that inpatient care that's provided, but usually just as a stepping stone to somebody needing care outside of Alaska oftentimes. So people can reach out, and that's one good reason why, if you have a concern, reach out now, because you can hopefully then help somebody get help at that outpatient level before things rise to a level where they might need a higher level of care, and you can only achieve that by leaving the state.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Dr. Pete, how was your relationship here to Alaska? It sounds like a lot of advisory role. What would you recommend in terms of encouraging people to seek care either in the state or out of the state of Alaska?
If you're in the state of Alaska, I couldn't agree more with Jenny. I think Akita is a great place to start. These are folks that really have on the ground knowledge about the providers that are in the area, but also having connections with other folks that may not necessarily be immediately apparent. And so I think that if you're looking for things that are local and going to be relevant to the context in Alaska, Beth and Jenny are great folks to be working with, frankly. You know, at the National Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders, given that we're a federally funded organization, our charge is to really be able to provide resources and guidance that would be applicable across the nation. And so that means that our focus tends to be a little bit more broad and a little bit less state specific, if that makes sense. But with our organization, really what we try to do is provide healthcare providers with as many resources, different kinds of educational products that help kind of provide the context, provide the knowledge and skills that are necessary to detect and manage these conditions in a clinical setting. We also do a lot of work with organizations like AKITA or other organizations that are focused on eating disorders in various states, so that we can help amplify the work that they're doing, so that we can help to distribute information that they might be sending out on patients and families, other different stakeholders. So really, it's a teamwork kind of effort to make sure that no matter where you are in the country, you can have access to the information that you need when it comes to eating disorders.
No, fantastic. And Jenny, here with our last few minutes, I know you guys have done quite a bit of work outside of the Anchorage Bowl and really, you know, statewide, even some of the rural areas. Can you comment on what's going on there?
Absolutely. Yeah, we are a statewide organization. And so we are the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance, not the Anchorage Eating Disorders Alliance. We had the pleasure of having Dr. Pete come to Alaska last fall, and we traveled with her to do some training of providers in Fairbanks and then all the way up to Ukiagvik as well. So we are really geared towards making sure that we are bringing information to providers in every community possible, because we do know that every community provider is seeing somebody with eating disorders, whether they know it or not. When you know that 9% of individuals are going to have an eating disorder at some point in your lifetime, whether you like it or not, if you are a provider, you are seeing people with eating disorders. And so we want to help you to have the skills and the knowledge to be able to better support those people. And I will say that if you are a provider, please come to our website. We have one of the main ways that AKITA is trying to help, in addition to the efforts that we give to individuals who are currently suffering from an eating disorder or support for their families. We have support groups, those kinds of things. But we are also really geared towards wanting to make sure that we are impacting the Alaska healthcare system so that we can better support these individuals. One of our board members early on told us, you know, if we go out there and we start increasing awareness about eating disorders, but we're not doing something at the same time to try to help our health system locally to be able to support these folks, we're probably not really helping very much. And so we really need to have that awareness growing in the community, but at the same time also be helping to support our fabulous local providers so that they can also do the work that they may not have had previous opportunities to get that kind of specialized training in.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You increase the awareness and then you have people asking about it. But if the doctors don't really know how to screen or what to do, it could be counterproductive. Yeah. So we have just about a minute left here. Jenny, I want to give you the opportunity. Any closing thoughts, closing remarks for our listeners that you want to get across?
Yeah, I guess my closing remark would be just if you are, I like to remind folks, this is a life-threatening illness. And so if you do have concerns, this is something to take seriously. It's something to talk to your doctors about. It's something to make sure that you're bringing up and having those conversations. It can be hard and awkward to have those conversations with somebody. But if you're concerned about someone, just as we know now that if you're concerned about suicide, that you have that conversation, you open up, you say, I've noticed these things. I'm concerned about you. And we know now that we should have those conversations. Similarly with eating disorders, this is also a life-threatening illness. And so if you're concerned about somebody, we really do like to encourage people to have that difficult conversation. You could save a life.
Absolutely. Dr. Pete here, we just got about 30 seconds, but do you want to give your website or any closing thoughts?
Sure. Our website is ncedus.org. But really, I think more importantly, my closing thought is that there is absolutely hope. These are treatable conditions. If you have an eating disorder, you don't have to live with it for the rest of your life. The sooner that you can get connected to care, usually the better. And with organizations like AKITA and NCED, I think it gives folks a good place to start. That's for sure.
Thanks so much. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Ammon Swenson. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.